Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So good to have on board with us in our Des Moines studio. Rachel Caulfield is with us of Drake University, where she's Associate Professor of Political Science. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
In Ames, our studio there, Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
You're out of breath, too. I am just reading through all the news. We've been out of breath for several weeks. Just in, what are we, in the third week of the Trump?
It's going to be a long 4 years.
Well, news-wise, we have a lot to chew over every week, at least have so far. Later on in the program, on this Politics Wednesday, we want to talk about, that knife-edge confirmation of the Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos. Steve Bannon, I want to have your thoughts, Jim and Rachel, about Steve Bannon and the degree to which he's the driving force behind this frenzy of activity coming out of the White House. Jim, we're going to rely on your foreign policy experience to tell us a little bit about how friends and foes outside of the United States are reacting to the first weeks of the Trump presidency. We'd like to have our listeners join in on this Politics Wednesday with your thoughts, your questions on, for instance, the president's battle over the travel ban. We'll be talking about that as well. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public or on Facebook to leave your question or comment. Let's talk about what led the NPR news there. This happened last night, the latest clash in the increasingly hostile debate over confirming President Trump's cabinet nomination for Jeff Sessions, evidently heading for a vote tonight. Last night, Senate Republicans passed a party-line rebuke of Senator Elizabeth Warren, the Democrat from Massachusetts, for a speech opposing the Attorney General nominee, Jeff Sessions. They struck down her words for impugning the senator's character. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell interrupted Warren's speech. The chamber was near empty. You can't tell that by the news coverage of the cameras. He said she had breached Senate rules by reading past statements against Sessions from figures such as Edward Kennedy, but also the late Coretta Scott King. Let's listen to a little bit of what happened on the Senate floor last night. Here's Senator McConnell interrupting Senator Warren in the middle of this confirmation hearing for Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama.
Senator Warren, quote, said Senator Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens. I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19.
Mr. President.
Senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate. I ask leave of the Senate to continue my remarks.
Is there objection?
Object.
I appeal the ruling.
Objection is heard. The senator will take her seat.
Okay. Shortly thereafter, Senator Warren, here she is a bit of her speaking outside the chambers, since she was not allowed to speak on the Senate floor after the Republicans voted to formally silence her.
Earlier tonight, I went to the floor of the United States Senate to debate whether or not Jeff Sessions should be confirmed to be the Attorney General of the United States. Now, back in 1986, Senator Sessions back then had been the U.S. Attorney, and he was rejected to be a federal judge. And one of the things that was important in both Republicans and Democrats deciding to vote against him was a letter from Coretta Scott King to the Judiciary Committee. Tonight, I wanted to read that letter, and Senator Mitch McConnell and the Republicans came to the floor to shut me down for reading that letter. So right now what I'd like to do, I'm outside the Senate, I just want to read the letter.
Okay, Senator Warren last night outside the Senate. We obviously don't have the 15 or so minutes we would take to read that letter, but one of the lines that Senator McConnell, Majority Leader, objected to was the use of the awesome power of this office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens that Coretta Scott King wrote. Rachel, tell us, dissect this a little bit for us. Give us your view on what happened and what the fallout is.
Well, I think, first of all, Rule 19 is one of those obscure Senate procedures that we never hear about. It's almost never employed. It was initially instituted after a fistfight on the floor of the Senate in 1902. This is not something that we normally see in the U.S. Senate. I think, really, Mitch McConnell, in using it in this instance, I think what he did is he actually amplified the message. Elizabeth Warren is incredibly savvy on social media. She has used that to her advantage. And at this point, this has become a much bigger issue than it would have been had she just simply been allowed to read the letter last night.
And then, as we heard in the news at the top of the hour, Bernie Sanders, other senators, mm-hmm. are being allowed to read the letter. I'm not sure about the details of why they're allowed, but...
apparently they're being... I mean, McConnell's justification for this is that it didn't come on the heels of some remarks that Warren had quoted from Edward Kennedy. And so Ted Kennedy had said some things about Jeff Sessions also in 1986. And so it seemed, apparently, contextually, it seemed to be more, more strong, I guess, when Elizabeth Warren was talking about it. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, there are a lot of women out there in particular who are really rallying around this idea that, you know, Elizabeth Warren, her voice has been silenced. And the way that McConnell explained this afterwards has become a meme unto itself now.
Oh, do you have that quote here?
She was warned. It was explained to her and she persisted.
Maybe a slogan for 2020. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
Jim McCormick. So we have the two questions here. Was it justified under the rules of the Senate? And I guess perhaps the bigger question, was it wise for Mitch McConnell to do this?
Well, there is Rule 19, as Rachel pointed out, and it does say that no senator in debate shall directly or indirectly in any form words impute another senator or other senators any conduct or motive unworthy of becoming a senator. So I suppose that has been invoked. It seems to me it's in terms of whether it's a very smart move, I think, is really questionable. I mean, I think it's really a metaphor for what has happened in terms of our debate. Unfortunately, even in the most deliberative body, we think of the U.S. Senate as that very serene, debating kind of chamber. And, of course, what we've seen and what this incident reflects is sort of the degradation of that body. And I think, as Rachel pointed out, what it really has, it has backfired. It's actually given Senator Warren much greater publicity and the whole debate over Jeff Sessions a greater amplitude, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what happened in the Senate a little bit earlier. The setting was congressional switchboards having been jammed in the confirmation process of the U.S. Secretary of Education, Betty DeVos. Two Republican senators defecting, Democrats holding a last-ditch 24-hour Senate debate. They needed just one additional vote. It was not enough, though, for the Democrats to prevent Betsy DeVos from becoming the U.S. Secretary of Education. She's a Michigan-based Republican activist, former state party chairwoman. She squeaked through the confirmation process, a tie-breaking vote of Vice President Mike Pence. Notably, the first time a vice president's tie-breaking vote was needed to confirm a presidential cabinet appointment. What jumped out at you about this confirmation process, Rachel?
Well, this has been a controversial nomination from the beginning, and Democrats, you know, of all of the cabinet nominees, they've really chosen this one to fight. And they knew they were going to lose. The announcement by Senators Collins and Murkowski that they would be willing to vote against her, and they felt that that was appropriate. So the defection of two Republican senators, I think, gave them some sliver of hope that they would find a third Republican who was willing to defect. That didn't happen. And so, you know, what we hear now from a lot of these labor organizations, teachers' unions, people who have been very active and vocal on this particular confirmation fight, they're now saying, look, just because she's the Secretary of Education, it doesn't mean that we're not going to continue to fight her on the policy issues.
Mm-hmm. She's the first Secretary of Education since that department was created back in 1979 to have neither attended nor sent her children to a public school. Do you get the sense, Jim, we're looking for a big change in the public school systems here in the United States because of this confirmation? Or
well, she's a real advocate, as you know, of charter schools. So, you know, and the administration, at least President Trump, has talked about moving about $20 million around to maybe foster, you know, more school choice for individuals and for where they might want to send their children and in terms of homeschool. I think what we also have to be cautious about, there's obviously a lot of bureaucratic inertia here that would be very hard to overturn in terms of support for public education. And I think that will be a real stumbling block, given her lack of really experience in this area in terms of administration. So I think it's probably less likely that she's going to have the kind of dramatic impact that some of the things have been advertised. I also think moving around $20 million is going to be very difficult to accomplish in the short term.
Mm-hmm. You're referencing $20 million. Explain that a bit.
Well, there is apparently, you know, monies available for, you know, some discretion within the Department of Education, and that would be monies that could be used either to support public education or this kind, or maybe a school choice on the part of some individuals to support individual students.
Just spent some time in New York, and it was interesting. I don't know if these ads also ran in Iowa. But the ads supporting her nomination were very interesting because they really entirely messaged on the idea that she was a supporter of offering choices for low-income and minority students. And so it's kind of a different tact than we've seen on some of the school choice arguments. And it's pushing a narrative that our public schools are failing most notably in those areas, and they're failing those students. And so, you know, the idea that she's going to come in and shift policy dramatically in order to advance school choice, and even, you know, she did this and she led the effort in Michigan and Detroit, and a lot of the supporters of school choice who really were gung-ho for the charter school system that was set up in Detroit now say that it really isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
There is really an issue with public education. I mean, I hate to...
No, absolutely.
I mean, you know, I'm involved in that, but I mean, there are some issues at both the elementary and the secondary level in terms of the kind of performance that we have seen and the decline, even in the state of Iowa. So I think there needs to be attention to both the public education and maybe for some kind of choice that might be available for some parents.
Zooming out a little bit on this confirmation process of Trump's cabinet, Democrats unable to stop the confirmations. Of course, they don't have the majority in either of the houses. It requires a simple majority. They have countered by using some extreme delaying tactics. They've dragged out this process longer than any in history for a new president's cabinet, I have read. Donald Trump tweeting about this: "It is a disgrace that my full cabinet is still not in place, the longest such delay in the history of our country. Obstruction by Democrats." Rachel, would you put it all at the feet of the Democrats?
I wouldn't put it all at the feet of the Democrats. He was a little slow in announcing many of his cabinet picks. And, you know, just objectively looking at who he has chosen, these are not your traditional cabinet picks. And so, you know, the idea that the Senate's taking some additional time and Democrats in particular are objecting to them in a different kind of way, that's, I think, what we would probably expect from folks who really have no history in government service or in the fields in which they will now head agencies.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the immigration ban, the travel, so-called travel ban, court fight. Perhaps a quick summary of the key events up to now, starting with yesterday. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments over how a lower court's decision to halt President Trump's executive order banning travel from the seven majority Muslim countries. It was on Friday, the 27th of January, that Trump's executive order banned refugees from entering the U.S. for 120 days, blocked for 90 days travel from seven countries, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, and barred immigration from Syria indefinitely. Trump says the ban was needed to give his intelligence agencies time to implement what he called extreme vetting procedures for people coming from those terror-prone countries. Here is the president speaking while delivering remarks to the members of the military at MacDill Air Force Base this past Monday.
Radical Islamic terrorists are determined to strike our homeland as they did on 9/11, as they did from Boston to Orlando to San Bernardino, and all across Europe. You've seen what happened in Paris and Nice. All over Europe, it's happening. It's gotten to a point where it's not even being reported. And in many cases, the very, very dishonest press doesn't want to report it. They have their reasons, and you understand that.
Okay, we have a couple things tied up here. We want to get to the court argument in just a moment, but we have this question of the media not reporting terrorist attacks in the president's remarks there. Doesn't want to report it. Of course, this made the major news media go out and look at how much they'd reported. The White House provided a list of 78 attacks from 2014 through December of 2016. Ones that the White House says they got short shrift on the news media coverage, news media fact-checking app. That turns out the news media have covered the large majority of such attacks. Jim, what do you make of this claim that we're the news media is not covering terrorist attacks by Islamic radicals well enough?
Well, I think the most generous kind of statement you could make is this is an overstatement by President Trump here. I mean, because, in fact, as you pointed out, the news media was quick to sort of look at that 78 items and see how many they've reported. And I know immediately CBS News reported the number that I think they were at 74% that they had reported on. So I think that you know, I don't think there's much to credence can be put that these were just simply not reported on. Now, the question is how much in-depth reporting did you want on these?
Mm-hmm.
You know, becomes sort of, I suppose, somewhat of a source of debate. But as you know, in the news business, if the item is not particularly newsworthy, you know, it's probably not going to, you know, catch much top line discussion here. So
right, and if I can just jump in, the more things happen, the more they, even though, you know, they fade a little bit into the background. We pointed out on a previous program here, school shootings, mass school shootings in this country happen almost every day.
Uh-huh.
Now, we don't report on them every day.
Sure.
We did back when they didn't happen very much, but be aware that they're. So I'm seeing this as kind of a similar thing, right?
Sure. It's kind of the degree of, let me not exaggerate, but sort of the sensationalist of the event. Is something that's going to get a lot more attention, like the Orlando or San Bernardino, than maybe I noticed there was discussion of some knife attack by a student or something like that. That's probably not going to get the national exposure that apparently the Trump administration is desiring here. So I think there is a decay effect that occurs with these kind of events when they take place.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, our president, repeatedly accusing the media of being dishonest, especially in coverage of him. Here's a tweet for you to react to, Rachel. this is a quote, a tweet from the president, any negative polls are fake news, just like the CNN, ABC, NBC polls in the election. Sorry, people want border security and extreme vetting. What do you see going on here, Rachel?
You know, one of the things I think is really interesting, it seems as though he kind of picked up on the term fake news, and now any news that he doesn't like is fake news. And it's a way of kind of lessening the force of the term fake news, right? If everything is fake news, then nothing is fake news, and we don't need to worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you mean.
We can just say, hey, that's just what it is. But certainly among his supporters, right, this is a dominant narrative of theirs, which is that the mainstream media just simply isn't getting at the real American, isn't understanding what they're feeling. And so when Donald Trump says things like that, I think it reinforces the notion that, you know, there's this forgotten group of Americans out there who the mainstream media is just simply ignoring.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the problem is, and Ben, you may be familiar with this, is that if you look at the Gallup polls over time, the degree of trust in the media, you know, continues to be at a relatively low ebb. Not as low as Congress, but
it's hard to get that low.
But at a relatively low ebb, and I think, you know, this attack on the media by the president, of course, you know, it just simply acts as a reinforcement. What I'm interested in is, given these kind of attacks that have occurred on the media, has this, you know, stimulated within the news process itself, and I don't know the answer to this, kind of a reevaluation of what they have been doing, and I'd be interested to know if that actually has occurred or not.
We've done some programs on media ethics and so forth here in the past. Maybe time for another one of those. Of course, quite lengthy to go into that, but I
sure.
assure you, the term fake news and so forth has been talked about quite a bit. And what happens when there is so much out there that is fake news? How do you deal with it as a news media organization? Very good point.
Well, with the internet and all of the things, I went to see my doctor a week or so ago. He said, "Don't read about the internet about these kind of things. You know, don't believe anything. Only believe what I'm telling you about the studies that actually have been done."
And who is this? Is your dentist who has the truth?
No, this is my doctor.
Your doctor.
Yeah.
So whoa, go. Oh, well, maybe he needs to be on politics.
Yeah, really.
Okay, we'll be. And
I would note very quickly. It was interesting to me talking to students during the election. I think this is the first generation of new voters that truly believes that all media is biased, that there is no such thing as neutral, objective fact that can be reported by media. And I found that just really striking, their distrust of media.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back. More with Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Jim's doctor, not on this show, maybe on a future show. We'll be back. We'll talk about this travel ban court fight, the arguments, and get Rachel and Jim's opinions on this lawsuits, and perhaps it will be decided by the end of the week, we hear. Also, I want to get their view on Steve Bannon. The first few weeks of the Trump presidency have brought a lot of attention to his White House chief strategist, Steve Bannon. Who is this man, and how much power does he really have? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break. We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday, today with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, and with you, if you'd like to participate, join our conversation. The latest, we can't cover everything on the political landscape. There is just too much happening. But some of the bigger things that are jumping out, of course, we want to talk about the court fight over the travel ban imposed by the president temporarily on these seven countries. 1-866-780-9100. The president addressing a law enforcement conference this morning in Washington. I'm reading on my screen, Jim and Rachel. Here's his latest oral argument, if you want to put it that way, for why the court should decide in his favor. It's sad. I think it's a sad day. I think our security is at risk and will be at risk until such time as we are entitled and get what we are entitled to as citizens of this country. It is done for the security of our nation, the security of our citizens, so that people come in who aren't going to do us harm, and that's why it was done. It couldn't have been written any more precisely. It's not like, oh, gee, we wish we were written better. It's beautifully. We wish it were written better. It's written beautifully, says the president. Well, Minnesota, Washington State joining a lawsuit against the ban. They won a temporary restraining order from the federal judge in Seattle. The circuit court will decide this week. We're told what by the end of this week whether that ruling will be upheld. Let's listen to a couple of arguments, and then Jim and Rachel, have your views in here as well. Last night, the Ninth Circuit Court heard oral arguments by phone about Trump's travel ban. Here's Judge Richard Clifton questioning Washington State Solicitor General Noah Purcell.
I have trouble understanding why we're supposed to infer religious animus when, in fact, the vast majority of Muslims would not be affected as residents of those nations.
Your Honor, the case law from this court and the Supreme Court is very clear that to prove religious discrimination, we do not need to prove that this order harms only Muslims or that it harms every Muslim. We just need to prove that it was motivated in part by a desire to harm Muslims.
Do I have to believe everything you allege and say, well, that must be right? That's not the standard.
Okay, here's another snippet of the proceedings yesterday. Judge William Canby questioning the lawyer representing the Justice Department, August Flingey, about the scope of the president's power.
Could the president simply say in the order, we're not going to let any Muslims in?
That's not what the order does here.
Could he do that?
Would
anybody be able to challenge that?
That's not what the order does here.
Okay, I think those arguments went on for something like over an hour at least. So, Rachel, tell us your analysis so that an accessible version of the arguments presented by either side.
Well, so I think one of the things that makes this confusing is that it's moved really fast, and so the legal arguments have all kind of gotten tangled up together. The primary argument, which is what you heard in both of those exchanges, primary argument that's being made by Washington and Minnesota is that this is a constitutional issue and that it's a violation of the First Amendment to discriminate on a class of people based on religion. And in order to justify that argument, they're saying, look, all you have to do is go back and look at Trump's own words during the campaign. This is not actually about national security. That's a thinly veiled justification. It's really about religion. But there are two other issues at stake here. One is a procedural issue, and that's the issue of standing, whether or not the states themselves have suffered any real harm. If they have not suffered real harm, then they cannot bring this lawsuit in the first place. Mm-hmm. To say that they're bringing this lawsuit on behalf of their citizens, if the state can't demonstrate real harm, then they don't have standing for the case, and the citizens themselves would have to bring separate cases. So that's one of the other issues at stake here. And then a third issue is a statutory issue under the 1965 immigration law, which Congress explicitly said in that law that immigration decisions cannot be based on a series of characteristics, including race and including national origin. Mm-hmm. And so, when you package all that together, what the U.S. government is arguing is they're saying, look, this is about national security. The court can't possibly know about the ins and outs of national security. The executive branch has additional information that we really can't share, right? that wouldn't be wise. So we're not going to share that information with you. But trust us, this is why Congress has deferred to the executive on these immigration decisions for so long.
The president, of course, tweeting about this several times. The tweet that caught a lot of ears was this tweet: "The opinion of this so-called judge, which essentially takes law enforcement away from our country, is ridiculous and will be overturned." Jim, calling a federal district judge a so-called judge, unprecedented?
It really is unprecedented, and really, I think, frankly, uncalled for. I mean, we really want an independent judiciary, and that's not the way to respect, the separation of powers within the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. I thought that what Rachel has laid out here in terms of some of the issues, I just wanted to throw in one other thing that, of course, the administration is relying on heavily. I mean, you mentioned national security, but, there is at least a court tradition on national security issues. It's really hard for presidents to lose. Not that they haven't lost on occasion. Most recently, President George W. Bush lost some cases with regard to enemy combatants and so on. But the preponderance of decisions have really, sort of the courts have really deferred to the president on national security issues. And this goes back really to a case in the 1930s of Curtis Wright. And this is really, I think, what the administration is hanging its hat on in terms of the powers of the president in the sort of the foreign policy realm. I heard some of this presentation. I didn't hear all of it. But at least I came away from that thinking that the administration, given the kind of questioning that I heard, would have a hard time winning this this decision. The only thing that I thought of is that they might come out of this if, in fact, the justices were to strike down part of the order and leave in place, for example, the 120-day banning for time of refugees so that we could improve our vetting. And that would get away from any kind of nationality considerations, identifying particular nations or particular religions, because the other prohibitions, inciting these seven countries and so on, and invoking that section about favoring some minority religions, I think the court will probably strike that down.
Mm-hmm. Jim, especially with your look abroad and your analysis abroad, how has the rest of the world viewed this controversy? Because we are tied into the rest of the world in so many ways in 2017, and the rest of the world viewing this, and some of our adversaries using it against us, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, some of our staunchest allies, I mean, the sort of the most topical item in the last couple of days was what the Speaker of the British Parliament said, that, he would oppose having President Trump, if he were to visit the U.K., to speak before Parliament. And there's petitions both for and against and the larger preponderance of not having a visit by President Trump here. And certainly the Iranians on the other side have used this, the Ayatollah coming out and saying this really shows the kind of the true face of the American system and in terms of human rights and so on, and using that as sort of a club against the Americans. Mm-hmm. The only area where that got some reception, of course, has been among the National Party, National Front Party in France, and their presidential candidate, who has really trumpeted,
there you go.
the idea of what the president has been doing.
Right, and with eyes on France as well, upcoming elections,
a
surge by Marine Le Pen. The right-wing candidate there will be watching that. I'm looking at the clock. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. I want to get a quick word from either of you or both of you about Steve Bannon, the first weeks of the Trump presidency, bringing a lot of attention to the White House's chief strategist, Steve Bannon. Tell us, Rachel, who is he? A little bit of background on him. How much power does he seem to have?
Well, I think... So he comes from Breitbart News, and he was obviously a very important advisor to Trump during the campaign. And a lot of people really saw him during the campaign as the person who kind of sharpened Trump's appeals to what is variously called the alt-right movement.
And when we define that, we're talking about sort of white, broadly speaking, the white nationalist movement, and we can think about it as in opposition to more multicultural views, visions of America.
I would say, yeah, the white nationalist movement is a part of it. It's a relatively small part, depending on which definition of the alt-right you want to use. But the alt-right, I think, certainly relies on this idea that there is some moment in American history where traditional American values had extreme power, and that those values have really been undermined by progressives. And yes, part of that then is by the introduction of multiculturalism, by the political correct language that everybody's interested in using to, you know, to broaden appeals. So they see a, you know, they see today's society as wildly out of step with this traditional American perception that they have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are, as I said, there are kind of various definitions of who this is, who this alt-right movement is.
When you look at what's happened in the first two-plus weeks of the Trump presidency, does the strategy, one of the strategies or tactics here seem to be overwhelm the opposition with sort of chaos?
I'm not sure that's a stated strategy. I think a lot of this is instinctual. It's a, look, let's try to get back to some of the core points, right? And so on immigration, for example, you know, I think there are people within the administration at this point who are willing to say that the rollout of this executive order maybe was not as smooth as
even
it could have or should have been.
Even the GOP has described it
absolutely
as flawed, poorly implemented as well.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. But, you know, I think there is an effort to move as quickly as possible on some of these key campaign promises. And the executive order on immigration was one of those. Every administration, when it comes into office, it tries to act quickly on key campaign promises. That's why that 100-day mark is so important, right? This is what I'm going to do on the day one. This is what I'm going to do in my first 100 days while they still have political capital. One of the differences here is that President Trump actually didn't have that much political capital when he came into office. And so, you know, trying to get these things through as quickly as possible is sometimes appearing very clumsy and not well executed. Steve Bannon, for his part, you know, it's unclear what role he's going to play. Certainly he is a target for those on the left who want to kind of identify where these ideas are coming from. And I think the effort to understand his role and or overstate his role is in some ways kind of a way to taunt President Trump. So it's a way of saying, look, you know, you have no power. Steve Bannon has the real is the real power of the presidency right now. And that's, you know, everyone just sort of expects that Donald Trump doesn't like that perception so much.
Rachel Caulfield with us of Drake University, finishing up the hour with Rachel and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Jim, I wanted to ask you especially about what we saw a few days ago, President Trump seemingly continuing to defend Russian President Vladimir Putin in his pre-Super Bowl interview with Bill O'Reilly. The U.S. president dismissed Fox News host's description of the Russian, Bill O'Reilly. The president, Bill O'Reilly, said described Putin as a killer. And Trump's response, there are a lot of killers. What do you think? Our country is so innocent. Now, this caused a lot of reaction also within the GOP. Here's a clip from Tuesday's comments by Senator John McCain speaking about a little bit of context needed here. He's speaking about Russian critic and deputy leader of the Freedom Party, Vladimir Kara-Murza, recently hospitalized in Russia, whose lawyer believes he was poisoned, just so you know the reference at the beginning of this. But when he talks about moral equivalence, he's really talking about what President Trump said to Bill O'Reilly in that pre-Super Bowl interview.
Vladimir knew that there was no moral equivalence between the United States and Putin's Russia. I repeat, there is no moral equivalent between that butcher and thug and KGB colonel and the United States of America, the country that Ronald Reagan used to call a shining city on a hill. And to allege some kind of moral equivalence between the two is either terribly misinformed or incredibly biased. Neither can be accurate in any way.
Senator John McCain there. Jim, give us your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's really, that really sort of says it all, I think, in terms of, you know, the sort of the dangers of kind of moral equivalence here. I frankly am puzzled and continue to be puzzled by Trump's fascination with Putin. If he really thinks he's going to gain anything, doesn't he understand that Putin has been really wily in terms of his time in office since 2000? And to equate American actions with the actually the individual killings, not just the one that, Senator McCain was referencing, but there's been a whole list of killings of individual, at least on clear bases.
Tens of journalists. I'm thinking 40 or 50 journalists dead under Putin.
That's right. So it's not, it's a much understated kind of notion that Putin is somehow not a real danger and not, as I think also as McCain said, a real thug.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump tweeting this week, "I don't know Putin. I have no deals in Russia, and the haters are going crazy. Yet Obama can make a deal with Iran, number one in terror, no problem." End of tweet by the president. And it brings us to the question as we get to the end of the hour, Jim, what is the state of the deal that was made by between the U.S. and other powers and Iran on their nuclear capabilities? Is that in tatters now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that what has happened is that the Trump administration seems to be pulling back a little bit. Yes, they did last week announce some additional sanctions over Iran in terms of their, missile testing here. But I think they're not willing to yet. They're still studying, as they say, the Iran nuclear deal. And they were very careful, even in these imposition of these new sanctions, not to tread on areas of that were prohibited in terms of any kind of new sanctions under the Iran nuclear deal. So I think they're being very careful about not violating that and giving the Iranians a reason to sort of outrightly reject the deal. I think it's also important, of course, because the European allies, the other, it's the P5 plus one that originally made this deal, European nations here, they would be very, very reluctant and further kind of a problem for the Trump administration if that Iran nuclear deal went asunder.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't the U.S., though, have, back to Russia, some national security interests that benefited from improved relations between Washington and Moscow, the risk of nuclear war, nuclear terrorism? There are some areas that overlap, right?
Well, I mean, the biggest claim, of course, is that the Russians will help with regard to ISIS in Syria. President Trump did talk about, at one juncture, reducing nuclear weaponry. But I don't know of any ongoing, since the sort of the New START agreement back in 2010, that there's really been any movement in terms of new negotiations to lower the sort of the nuclear temperature, the nuclear threshold. So I'm not sure that we're going to see much immediate progress there. But perhaps with regard to maybe keeping Iran in a box and maybe dealing with Syria, you could spin a tale that some kind of cooperation with Russia would be helpful, and maybe they would ease the pressure. Although even within recent days, the actions within Ukraine suggest a different story.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, this to you, mm-hmm. with President Trump's continuing defense of Vladimir Putin, what kind of position does this put congressional Republicans in? A Republican Party, of course, one that has traditionally viewed Russia, especially during the Cold War and beyond, as a great adversary.
Well, and we certainly just heard John McCain's comments.
Yes.
I think there are a number of prominent Republicans who, on key issues, are really distancing themselves from the president, and this is one area that's become most prominent. We're seeing a number of congressional leaders, but also people in Congress who specialize in foreign affairs who are stepping back from this. If Trump wants to pursue any sort of deal with Russia, he's going to have to convince his party to come along with him. And I think that's actually politically, that's not an easy play for him.
He may have to also confront his cabinet, because there's some members in his cabinet that take a different view of Russia than what he's tweeted about.
Okay. Hard to believe, less than 3 weeks into the Trump presidency, so much to talk through. We didn't get through it all, but we'll have you certainly on again. Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Great to have your expertise, and we'll look forward to talking with you again. Very quickly, Rachel, what do you have your eyes on in the coming week?
I have my eyes on the Supreme Court nomination.
Okay. We didn't talk about that at all.
Nope.
See, that's a big one we missed.
That's a big one.
Jim, what about you?
I think the continued reaction of the Europeans to Trump that's going to be crucial here, Germany in particular.
Okay. In the future, we'll turn to both of you for your expertise. Rachel and Jim, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today from Chelsea Hoy as well. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.